Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today we're thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with Stanford head football coach David Shaw. Coach Shaw, thanks for joining us. You've made it to the big time. Congratulations on being a guest of an obscure volleyball coaching podcast.
I've been looking forward to it.
Good. So our topic today is leadership. And the first question we want to ask is, do you think leadership is a learned skill or something you're born with?
I think you're born with your own version of leadership to a certain degree. And I think you can improve or get worse, kind of up to you, your mentality and your attitude towards leadership. But I believe that everybody has some form of it, and some are more vocal about it than others. And some, honestly, as all coaches know, some people actually just turn away from it and don't want any part of leadership at all. But others, the ones that we always appreciate, the ones that find their own way to lead. And I think that's kind of our job, coach, is to identify it and try to cultivate it.
And what traits do you think are most important for productive leadership?
Well, I think the most important part of it for me is the ability is just doing the right things, right? I mean, because before you can speak, you have to establish your willingness to work hard, do your job, do it well, play your role, all those things that teams need. And because before you can truly be an effective leader, you have to demonstrate something to your teammates first. Well, whether, you know, and most of it is whatever sport it is, and we're talking sports right now, anyway, but and you don't have to be a great player, a great athlete, but I think you have to show that you care about the team and that you're going to work extremely hard and do what it takes to help the team be successful. And I think you don't naturally just become a leader. I think the team puts you in a leadership role based on how they respond to you, whether it's verbally or non-verbally.
Can you point to any specific ways that you try to help your young players grow these skills?
Yeah, I mean, some ways are more overt than others. There are, like at the end of every practice, I never, you know, bring the whole team together and like say something that everybody kind of repeats to quote break the team down. I always leave that to someone else. So it's not a big thing, but I usually will grab randomly different people at different times, in particular those that are playing well, those that are doing well. And whenever I say a person's name, a lot of times there's a cheer for that person because, you know, yeah, that guy should be breaking us down. That guy should be a leader on this team. You know, they get to say just a couple of words before they break us down at the end of practice. That's one for me, just for, you know, 60 seconds, putting a guy in front of the team. Other times, by changing their role on the team and, you know, putting them in a more important position, whether it's just more playing time or, you know, sending after the quarterback more, getting more catches or more runs. And sometimes it's more subtle. Sometimes it's someone I bring into the office and say, hey, you know what? I think you're showing great potential. And I think you're showing great leadership. And I think your voice really carries more. I think you can feel more confident in being able to talk and push the guys and tell the guys what, you know, needs to be done. So sometimes I think on an individual one-on-one basis, sometimes the guys feel more comfortable when I single them out privately and say, hey, you know, just so you know, I recognize what you're doing is really positive for this team. It's positive for you. And I see you as a leader. And sometimes it's just that one conversation that makes the guy feel good. Like, I'm doing the right things. I feel good about this. And I appreciate that. And sometimes it's giving them more responsibility. There are times where I've brought leaders in and said, hey, you know what? Player X is doing okay, but not really doing that well. And I think if I go talk to him, I think he'll He might not respond the right way. I think it might be good for you to go pull him aside and, you know, help him through whatever he's going through, or tell him that you're counting on him and help him do his job so he feels like he has an ally. So sometimes it's taking that person and putting him in a one-on-one leadership role where he can help someone else. Because sometimes that strengthens the bond between those two, but then also maybe kind of brings another sheep back into the fold that may be straying a little bit, because I've tightened the bond between that person and a leader on the team. Because I'm a firm believer in positive peer pressure. That doesn't always have to be negative. It can be positive. So sometimes when you can strengthen the bonds between your players, they don't want to let each other down. And they feel like, hey, you know, that guy went out of his way to talk to me. You know, I want to do right by him. And I think that can be a positive.
Do you think it's important that leaders are extroverted, or do you think it's possible to be an introverted leader?
Oh, yeah. And that's what I mentioned early on. I mean, it's 100% on your own personality. And I tell the guys, you know, the advice my dad gave me and when I first started coaching, he told me, first and foremost, coach with your own personality. And it was always a weird thing initially for me to hear somebody say, coach with my own personality. And really what he was saying was, don't ever be fake, don't ever be phony, just be who you are. Because I think a lot of times, especially for young coaches, they try to emulate someone else. And when you're trying to coach, and the worst thing you can do is be phony. The worst thing you can do is be false and not be yourself, because no matter what sport you coach, eventually the players figure it out. And it's hard to ever shake that as a coach if you're not real. So the same thing for leaders on a team, where those guys, some guys are just louder and more vocal, and that's great. They can be themselves and still lead. There are others that if they're not big vocal guys, then they don't have to be that much more vocal. But when I have one of those guys, I just let them know, okay, just remember, like, whatever you say is going to be very, very important. So if you want to choose your words carefully and you don't want to speak a whole bunch, just know every once in a while, if you just say a little bit, you're going to get a response from your teammates. So at different times we've had, you know, Bryce Love was like that. Not a vocal guy, but every time he spoke, you know, a couple times during the course of the year, the entire team looks at him, kind of responds. Because they know that he's kind of stepping out of his comfort zone a little bit, but he felt it's important enough for him to say something, and the guys responded to him. And we've had guys like David DeCastro, who's a great player, All-American first-round draft pick, that didn't really want to talk. But kind of the same thing I did with him, which is I say, you know what, you don't have to ever talk very much. As long as you work really hard, and you can start telling the other guys just to keep up with you. That's a form of leadership. Say, guys, I'm going to do the right things. Just come with me. And that was great. And that's pretty much what he did his last year at Stanford. And got guys to say, hey, you know, here's a great player. And all he wants us to do is work hard like him. And that was, I got a great response from his teammates.
It sounds like you're already pretty darn good at bringing or passing along leadership to your players. Can you point to any other leadership skills that you think you do well, and also what leadership areas do you want to develop in?
And you're talking about me personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing for coaches who've coached for a while, especially in college sports, is to not get into a rut. And I say rut is in a negative connotation. Sometimes it's a positive rut. Sometimes it's things that have worked for you before. But I think you have to recognize that the world changes, you know, and it's changing more drastically, more quickly. So what really worked on the same team 5 years ago may not work today. It may not work 2 years from now. What we do today may not work 2 years from now. So I think it's always recognizing who we have. And there are times I need to be a little bit more heavy-handed because we have youth on the team. There may be times I need to be more, I kind of need to step back more because I think we have emerging leadership and I don't want to crush it because I want it to truly develop. And I think what I've tried to do the last few years is be a lot more intentional about each thing that I do and a lot more open and direct with the guys, as opposed to just trying something on the team, just letting them know what I believe. And like this past year and a half, I've told the guys, hey, you guys are going to have to trust me. I want to earn your trust. But the first thing you're going to have to know is like when the leadership on the team is truly pushing the team more than me, that's when we win. But I can't just turn the team over to the leadership until the leadership earns that role. So like just letting them know, like, okay, I'm not playing mind games with you guys. I'm not trying to trick you guys at all. But if you hear me always being the bad guy in practice, telling guys to work harder, telling guys to do the right things, telling guys to not line up off sides, I said, if I'm doing that more than the team, then we're not in the position that leads us to success. So letting them know that I want them to lead and I need them to lead, and however they lead can be in conjunction with me, but the most powerful leadership on any team for me still comes from the members of the team.
That's such an awesome way of framing it.
What about within your staff? Do you see yourself as the sole leader, or do you feel like you have, you know, a bunch of leaders within your assistant coaches?
I've been very fortunate, not to name drop all the coaches that I've worked with, but a couple guys in particular that I was with them their first kind of major head coaching job. As I came to Stanford with Coach Harbaugh, who was the head coach of University of San Diego, but then also went with John Gruden to the Oakland Raiders the first time at the Oakland Raiders, 1998. So I got a chance to see young, energetic coaches take over big programs and learn from the things they did right, did wrong, things that they did right that maybe I would still do differently. And one of the biggest things that I learned to keep sanity as a head coach is one word: delegate. You have to have competent people around you, and you have to trust them to do their jobs, and you have to hand things to them, you know, and if you're not sure if they're going to do it the right way, then be very, very explicit. But I hand over things to our staff and say, okay, I need you to do this. I need you to handle this. So what happens is you're empowering your staff. You're giving them responsibility. You're giving them control of something and still hold them accountable to getting it done well and getting it done right. But also the players feel that also, right? So even our receivers coach, Poppy Kennedy, who does a great job, I'm a former receivers coach. I can't be over there coaching the receivers all the time, which sometimes I feel like I really want to just because I love it. I have to let him do it so that he becomes the leader of that group. And I have to allow that to happen. I have to step back because he feels ownership and the players feel like he's in it with them also. Same thing with the quarterbacks. In my history working with the quarterbacks, I have to let our offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach Tavita Pritchard handle the quarterback. So that's part of my responsibility is as I'm developing leadership on the team, I'm also developing it on my staff. I still think it's part of my responsibility to make sure that my staff continues to grow and learn. And, you know, anytime they want to do professional development in the offseason and go interview with someone, go talk about position coaches talking about becoming coordinators talking about becoming head coaches, I support that because I want them to grow in the profession and try to advance and try to get better. Because I think ultimately when they're hungry and they want to be good at what they do and I help promote that, I think our players feed off of that also. You know, we got a bunch of people working in our organization that everybody wants to improve. Everybody wants to be better. Everybody wants to push themselves. And I think that can go through the entire group of people that work together.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun culture to be a part of. What if someone has, one of your coaches has a very different philosophy on I don't know, say technique or the way they get feedback. What do you do in that situation?
So I try to be very open. There have been a lot of teams that have won championships running a 34 defense and some that have run a 43 defense. So neither one is right. They're just different. And either can work. So for me, if I have something I believe in, and one of my coaches has something that he believes in that's different, I'll say, okay, let's talk about it. And let's see if I can convince you, and let's see if you can convince me. And which is hard for my position sometimes because, you know, I'm the head coach, so I'm going to make the final say. But I remind him, like, no, like, you can convince me. If you can convince me, great. If you can't, then we're going to do it my way. But I'm going to give you the opportunity. And I'll see more often than not, if I have a position coach that is truly adamant, he has a history of doing something, 9 times out of 10, I'll step back and say, okay, great. Do it your way. You believe in it. You can coach it. And if it doesn't work, then we'll change it. But I'm going to give you that first opportunity to do it your way. And once again, putting it back on the coach to say, okay, great. This is your opportunity. Take control of this. And hopefully you can make it work, and I'll support you making it work, and I'll back you. But if it's not working, then when I come back and you recognize that I gave you an opportunity and it didn't work, and then we're going to do a different thing.
You've cited American Generalship as an influential book. Aside from a lot of similarities between football and military, just the physical nature of it, what other inspiration do you draw from military leadership?
That's a great question, because there, in my opinion, there is a hard line between that world and the athletic world. And I think sometimes people blur it a little bit too much.
Yeah.
I have great reverence for our armed forces, our military. I have great reverence for those men and women that lead other men and women in life-threatening situations where they're doing it for our betterment. That being said, for me, there's something to be said for how conscientious you need to be as a general. As a great general, you need to have what you believe, and at the same time, you have to have the betterment of other people before your own. You have to think about what is best for the United States, what's best for our democracy, what's best for our way of life, what's best for all the men, women, and children that may be 10,000 miles away from where you are. You have to take all those things into consideration. And at the same time, what is best for the men and women serving under me right now. So to make your decisions with that grand scope, that long lens, as I like to say, it makes every single decision very important. And at the same time, if you are trained and you've got great experience, you've got great advisors, you've got great people around you, you can make those decisions and feel great about what you have to do in order to make life better for all those people that I just mentioned. And I have a lot of respect for the people that get in those positions and treat them with the respect that they deserve.
Yeah. What kind of groups of people are in your long lens?
Well, honestly, we had a big thing we had to talk about during training camp today. I'm sorry, not today, but this past year, in August. And, one of our young guys didn't get into trouble, but was going through really difficult. And I was helping him go through it, as well, I think we all were. So I kind of just talked about my position. And I said, guys, don't think I have any other ulterior motives. I'm not doing my job to another job. I'm not trying to impress anybody. I'm trying to do what's best for this individual in his position on this football team. And I kind of gave them the scope of, He's like, guys, every move that I make has to do with all of you. At the same time, publicly, if I say something publicly, I choose my words very carefully because I'm speaking for you individuals on this team. I'm speaking for coaches. I'm speaking for my family. I'm speaking for Bernard Muir, my boss. I'm speaking for President Provost. I'm speaking for the alumni that are across this globe. I said, that's the scope that I think in to everything that I do publicly really has to represent everything I believe, but then also all those people that I'm representing. And I think when we're talking to young people, sometimes they have a very narrow scope and a very narrow focus, and sometimes a very momentary set of priorities, as opposed to, okay, what are greater priorities here? How am I going to react to a difficult situation? Am I going to do it emotionally, or am I going to do it and say, hey, you know what? This is a difficult situation. Let me take a deep breath. And my actions, my words are going to follow not only what I believe, but then also truly represent the people and institutions that are important to me.
Yeah. So, you know, talking about perspective, a lot of the, you know, student athletes, when they come in their first year, probably don't have as great a perspective as your fourth year student athletes. And you, as college coaches, we get to work with young people for 4 years at a time, sometimes five. What sort of things are you prepared for to work through in a player's first year development, and then their second, and then their third, and their fourth? And how does that change year to year? Are there certain trends that you see?
Well, football is unique in the volume of people. You know, to have we're typically 115 or less people on the team, but you have over 100 individuals all in different stages of their lives,
right?
And different stages of their time on campus, and different stages of their personal development. So we may have, you know, 20 freshmen on a team. Five of them may be mature. 10 of them may be right about age. Another five are less mature than they probably should be. And if you just take that 20, every year, some are going to grow, some are going to regret. So there's so many different individuals. One of the big things that I tell my staff is every player on our team needs an advocate, especially if they're going through something difficult, whether it's an injury or not playing or being far from home and getting over that, or I let school catch up on me. You know, now I've been procrastinating for 2 weeks now. The world's crashing down around my ears. So sometimes I'm that advocate, but you know, often a lot of guys don't really connect with the head coach because I'm kind of distanced from them. Some of them do, some of them don't. So sometimes it's a coordinator, sometimes it's a position coach. Sometimes it's just another guy on the team that they can rely on and talk to. So especially when the freshmen are coming in, I try to do a conscientious check-in periodically with each one of them at different times. And some guys I'll connect with, and some guys, they're kind of a little distant just because of my position. So I'll talk to the position coach, hey, make sure you're checking on, you know, so-and-so. You know, ask him something outside of football to see how he's doing. You know, ask him about home life, school, et cetera. So that we're helping with this transition from high school to college with more responsibility and more work. As guys then transfer over, it's not so usually not so much, hey, how are you doing? It's okay, hey, how you doing? Because here's some areas that we need you to grow. Here's some things I need you to do better. Hey, I need you to be more responsive. Like you've messed up the same thing five times. You're not a freshman anymore. You know, I'm not going to treat you like a freshman. I'm not going to pat you on the back and say it's okay. Hey, it's time for you to start learning, start growing, and stop making the same mistake over and over again. So I think and they're all individual, but as they grow, it's getting them to realize that they need to see themselves as growing. Then you see themselves, and one of the hardest things for anybody to do, in particular young people, is to truly look at yourself objectively. and say, hey, you know what? Sometimes I'm not always right. You know, gosh, I think I do need to do this better. You know, hey, I think I have been trying, but I don't think I've really been going all out. I think I can give more. You know, maybe the coach is right. Maybe I can do this XYZ better. So I think without necessarily escalating too fast beyond what they're ready for, but I think the relative escalation of responsibility and expectations, the longer they're with us. And I'm not talking about playing great. I'm talking about being mature, being responsible, doing a job, doing it well, having pride in your work, and also being a good example for some of the younger guys that we come in. So I can point and say, hey, you know what? Hey, young guy, see that your leader over there? He was just like you. So, you know, that's where you can be. So, you know, and sometimes grabbing that senior leader and say, hey, you know, this guy's having making the same mistakes you were. And you say, hey, you know, coach, I got him. Let me put my arm around him. Let me see how I made this transition to where I am. So, you know, trying to keep that cycle going, connecting old guys to young guys so that hopefully the young guys can grow and the old guys can appreciate that extra set of responsibilities.
So then as a leader of your team, is it important to you, or how much does it matter that your players like you?
That is a great and scary question. Like is an interesting word. Like is a temporary thing. Mm-hmm. We like and dislike things all the time. We like and dislike people all the time. So during difficult times where I have to, first of all, I tell my guys all the time, like sometimes being a real man is having difficult conversations. Like I have to have difficult conversations sometimes with my student athletes. And I tell them at times, look, it's not my job for you to like me now. Part of my job is that you like me 20 years out of Stanford. Like that's the person that I'm truly trying to tease. You know, 20 years from now, when you look back at this time, you say, you know, thank God Coach Shaw said that to me. Thank God he was hard on me. Thank God he raised the expectations on me, even though I didn't want him to. Thank goodness he held me to a higher standard than I was holding myself. Thank goodness he didn't let me get away with giving 80% effort when I knew I can give 90, 95, 100. So that's what I try to tell them in those different times. Like, I'm okay if you don't like me in the short term. But you know, sometimes if I just want more from you and I want better from you, at some point you're going to look back and say, I'm glad you did that to me, glad you did that for me. So that sometimes is difficult. But like I said earlier, I try to be very open and upfront with them and say, I'm okay if you get pissed at me. So you won't be the first of my players to get really mad at me and say some things under your breath, as long as I don't hear them, you know, or shoot those eyes at me periodically. That's okay. I understand that. But in the long run, if that makes you a better player and that makes you more responsible and makes you more conscious of your effort and your attention to detail and being responsible and responsive to your teammates, then that's great. I'm okay with putting our interpersonal relationship temporarily in a bad place, as long as in the long run, you will look back and appreciate me for it. And even in the intermediate run, it makes you a better player and makes us a better team.
I know as for sure humans and for sure college age players, people want gratification pretty quickly. But I love this idea of the long view. But how do you see people, you know, college age athletes responding to this kind of long view, long look at things?
Oh, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. Hard, in particular in college football and college basketball right now. I like to say we're in a, I think in our time right now, I think we're in a mini version of the 60s. I think we're very anti-establishment. I think so many people out there hate the NCAA. So many people out there hate college football coaches because they're holding these guys back and we're quote unquote taking advantage of them and all these crazy things. So a lot of the advice that these young people get as they're really young is, hey, get into college and get out as soon as you can so you can make money in the NFL. And that's so backwards and it's so strange that I don't really understand why people feel that way. Because I think the college years are supposed to be formative years. I heard one person say, and I think it's really cool to think of it this way. It's like the second puberty, right? They go through one version of puberty, but then college is another version, right? Where they go through a lot of change and emotion and all these things that are happening. So, you know, for this time that we get them, it's just for me to say, hey, you know what? Don't look past college. They're really good players. I mean, some of them come out of high school and they just say it. I'm going to be here for 3 years. Like, that's it. And I said, why make up your mind so soon? First of all, 3 years is a long time and there's a lot of development that needs to happen. You know, I can't tell you at 17 years old, which guys are going to be first round draft picks their third year at 20. I said, I can't. So for you to make up your mind that fast, and that early, I think is dangerous, as opposed to saying, hey, I'm going to come to Stanford. I'm going to work extremely hard. I want to get my degree. I want to play great on the field. And if I'm fortunate enough and lucky enough that my skill set is one that gets me to leave early, okay, so be it. Then I make that decision when that happens, as opposed to coming in with this mentality of, hey, I'm getting in as fast as possible because I'm going to go be a superstar. Those are the ones that look back and say, man, that went really fast. Like, what happened to my college time? And I feel bad for those people, because I tell our guys all the time, when I talk to these NFL athletes, many times the first or second subject we talk about is their time in college. Mm-hmm. It's formative. It's enjoyable. It's not a business. Those NFL and NBA and traveling sports, all the other sports that travel, play minor leagues or whatever, like those are jobs. You know, those are jobs. Those are difficult. They're not just your buddies that you're going to class with and staying in the dorms with and eating with and then going to practice with. So that's my thing with a lot of our guys, is to take a deep breath, slow down, enjoy today, and then enjoy tomorrow, and enjoy the things that we're doing now, before you get in a rush to go join this big, beautiful, shiny object that's the NFL, that for most people is a flash in the pan. It's temporary. Whatever's shorter than temporary, for most people, that's what it is. But it's such a goal, and I think so blinding for so many people that it causes them to have, I think, the wrong approach to college athletics.
That was part one. Join us next week for more talk on leadership from Coach David Shaw. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen. This is part two of our interview with Stanford football coach David Shaw on leadership.
I'm curious how you approach challenging situations as a leader. So say maybe after a tough loss or a team you shouldn't have lost to, how you approach those situations.
I'm sorry, say that again. I couldn't hear you.
Oh, after a tough loss, how you approach just leadership and, yeah, how you address your team.
So first of all, I'll just tell you what I've told the team multiple times, and it's well documented that I've been approached by NFL teams most postseasons. I've never given an interview. I've never talked to anybody. My agent has built a nice little wall around me that they talk to him, and he says thanks but no thanks. But what I told them is, one of the biggest things that I've heard from these NFL franchises is what puts me on their radar are post-game press conferences after a loss. and to be able to handle that difficult situation. Because first of all, you spent all week trying to find a way to win and you didn't win. Second of all, invariably something or multiple things went wrong that were out of your control, or they were in your control and you screwed them up. And then the third, and as important, that's when you get the best questions, right? That's when you get the worst questions, when you're in the worst mood, half an hour after the game's over, you still feel the emotion, the pain, the distraught feeling, and you get one of those ridiculous questions. And my mentality for that is, first of all, publicly, is I don't care what they ask me. I know what I want to say. So I walk into those press conferences with things that I want to make sure that I say. And no matter what the question is, I'm not going to over-respond or overreact to the question. I'm going to respond in such a way that I know I'm going to get my message across to the media, to our recruits, to alumni, to whomever is paying attention, so that I walk into that not in a reactive state, but I walk into that situation in a proactive state. Say, I've already got my thoughts together. I know exactly what I want to say and how I want to say it. So no matter what they ask me, I have my responses ready. Now, as far as dealing with my team, first and foremost, I take responsibility on my own shoulders, because that's where it should be. I don't like to go in there and say, hey, we just didn't do this right. Guys didn't block well, guys didn't run well, blah, blah, blah. I think before I ever point the finger at anybody else, I say, hey, you know what? Obviously, I didn't do this right. You know, gosh, that third down call, I wish I had that one back there in the second half. Should have done X, Y, Z, which is, I think, is a fine line sometimes, because you don't also want to say all of those things and leave it at that. So the players say, okay, well, you know, gosh, you don't know what you're doing. You screwed the whole game up. But there's something to be said for, hey, you know what? I'm in this with you all. You know, I think I can do this better. And what we need to do better as a team. So I think they need to hear both from us as coaches that, hey, here are the things that we could do better as a staff. Here are the things that we need to do better. Here are the things that actually led to us losing the game. I never mentioned the officials, and I never mentioned the other team. Hey, they played great. That's fine. They showed up to play great. Well, so did we. So who cares how many plays they made? Here are the things that we need to do. Right? You know, they completed 10 passes in a row. We got to find a way to disrupt the passing game. We got to get to the quarterback. We got to deflect some of these passes. Our needs to be tighter. You know, here are the things that we need to do in practice to make sure that we get better at this. So in times of difficulty, that's what our young people are looking for us, which is to take some responsibility, to give them some direction, to also at some point during that post game, I like to leave a little light at the end of the tunnel where it's mentioned, hey, the next three games are at home, right? We got a chance to go back home and reestablish winning streak in these next three games, blah, blah, blah. So I always like to give them something slightly in the distance that we can get through this uncomfortable, murky time to say, okay, coach is right. You know, we got Washington coming in next week. That's going to be a big game. So to put them on the next thing that's coming so that we don't all just dwell, I don't think that's a positive thing.
I love this idea and how objective you are and bringing in some data, like, you know, this specific thing happened in the game. But I'm wondering, is this done like the next day or is this after the game? Because I'm just curious, like after a loss, your emotional state, if you're able to be that objective, maybe you are.
Yeah, I usually am. And that's impressive. I've been teased periodically. I think mostly good natured, not all, but mostly good natured. And my sideline demeanor, I'm pretty calm. I'm pretty methodical. I'm pretty straightforward. I'm not very emotional. I'm periodically with the officials, but that's another story. And I think I'm very calculating. So I get a good idea of the things that go on during the course of the game. And like most coaches, a lot of the negative things stick in our craw. So after a game, I can usually rattle off the 3 to 5 things that could have helped turn the game back around in our favor. Whether it's, hey, it's so many second and longs. I mean, second and 10, second and 12, second and 15. It's hard to be an offense if we're always behind the chains. So I think a good idea of the things that we could have done better. And some things come up after you watch the film that you don't know right off the hand. But typically, even after a win, sometimes they say, hey, we got to do this, this, and this better. Sometimes that's the best time to grab their attention on some things that we can do better. Gosh, we won by 7. Gosh, we could have won by 21 if we did this and this, and this is where we need to get better for next week. There's also something that I tell the guys periodically, and it's an interesting concept to grasp. Now, I was a social psychology major, but I loved philosophy. I took a couple of philosophy classes, and they've always stuck with me. And I heard something someone said a long time ago that was very philosophical. And for great competitors, I think the great competitors truly understand this. For me, it's this concept of great competitors and great winners. They treat victories and losses the same. They treat it the same. They're data points. Hey, I won, but gosh, I could have done this, this, and this better. And I won because this and this and this. I got to continue to do those things. Hey, we lost. Gosh, you know what? Here are the good things that I did that I know I can do better. And these things. So every win or loss is something that happened. What can I take from it? So I think when you have that mentality, you keep yourself from the depths after a difficult loss. And say, okay, great. Hey, this is what happened. If we're going to be worth a doggone this year, we're going to bounce back from this. We're going to have guys step up. We're going to have guys play better. You know, we're going to have to create some competition because, you know, so-and-so's not playing great and didn't play well. So, hey, no offense, but now you're going to be competing for playing time with this other guy. So whoever wins this competition is going to play because we need to do that so we can be better. I think understanding that losing a game is not always the worst thing. Sometimes it becomes a battle cry. And I'll even bring this up. One of the best reasons we went to the Rose Bowl the 2015 season, outside of Christian McCaffrey having an unbelievable video game type year, was the fact that we went to Northwestern and lost the first game. And we were horrendous on offense. Absolutely horrendous on offense. And it kind of became a rallying cry, a battle cry for us the entire year, where our guys were truly embarrassed. And we said, you know what, that can't be who we are. We can play so much better than that. And, you know, so we came back, we played a couple games at home and played well on the road. And our guys, I didn't have to say it. It's one of those things where the leadership starts to take over. And I heard the guys saying, like, hey, we're going on the road. We're not going to play like we did play at Northwestern. We're better than that. We're going to be a better road team, you know, and you hear that pride and that look like we are better. We have to. So I don't know that season ends up the way that it ended up with record guys breaking records, winning the conference, breaking Rose Bowl records. For me, it really started in that loss at Northwestern because we had the team responded. You know, the whole season ended up being a response to a negative situation. So not all losses are bad. Sometimes they end up driving you. And as I like to say, all successful people have scars, you know. So it's okay sometimes to get that scar as long as you learn from it and grow from it.
Well, lots of good stuff in there. I could definitely taking a lot of notes. This is great stuff. We have one more in leadership. Just wondering who some of the leaders are that you admire and who you've learned from. It's clear you have just a great model and foundation of leadership, and wondering who's inspired that.
Yeah, for me personally, there have been I think quite a few. Some that I've worked with, some that I haven't. I think when I was young, my dad was a football coach, so I always looked at football coaches. And I don't know if this is where I completely get it from. I can't say, but I loved Tom Landry, the Dallas Cowboys. Tom Landry seemed to always be in control. He was stoic. He was working with the offense, with the defense, working with the special teams, just kind of always seemed to be on top of everything. The players responded to him. They liked him. Some of them actually feared him. But there was that iconic, you know, gosh, that guy's got the team in the palm of his hands. You know, Chuck was like that. Yeah, that's Pittsburgh Steelers. So for me, I always looked up to those guys that, yes, they won, but they won in a fashion to where it didn't seem like it was happenstance. It seemed like it was orchestrated. It seemed like they had great players, but they put them in position to be successful. So those are a lot of my earlier memories of coaches. You know, then my dad being a coach and watching him give speeches and talk to guys and the attention that he commanded. Yeah, he was Air Force and rose through the ranks very quickly, and became kind of a leader in the military. I think that always carried through for him, that his words had gravity and he cared a lot about how his players, not just how they performed, but just how well they did their jobs. And it was important to him, and he drove them, and he pushed them, and he celebrated with them. At a young age, going to Western Washington and being at a small school, but winning the division the first year and going to the national championship the second year, and watching the head coach, Rob Smith, be a leader of that team and a pusher for that team, and seeing that, gosh, even as small arena that maybe we're not on national TV, but you can still perform at a high level. I always think about Brian Billick and my time with Brian Billick. He was my receivers coach at Stanford, my boss at the Baltimore Ravens. Brian was, as a head coach, he was the quote unquote CEO head coach, where he took a great overall view. It wasn't just calling plays and coaching guys. He took a great organizational view. He helped them design a new building that the franchise was moving into. Cared a lot about the salary cap and how the team was being put together. So he delegated a lot of the X's and O's to the coaches, and he kind of stood above it a little bit, which I don't do necessarily as much because I like being a little bit more involved in the day-to-day offense, defense, special teams. But that was the way that he chose to do it, and he did it such a way that he was great at it. Jim Harbaugh, a difficult situation at Stanford, where had won a lot, and probably the most important thing that he could give the young men that we were coaching was confidence. Like, forget about what plays we call, forget about everything else. We're going to go into the game, and we're going to go really, really hard, and we're going to fight whoever shows up. You know, so that was a form of leadership, just to stoke the competition in each individual on our team. You know, you can't make guys that are not competitive make them competitive, but we could stoke whatever competitive fire was in them and recognize it and put those guys in those situations, knowing that we're not going to be a great team initially, but we're going to scrap and we're going to fight and we're going to try to build something on effort. So that was just kind of off the top of my head, all of those guys that have influenced me at different times during my career.
Those are good ones.
That is extensive and thorough. Now for a really heavy hitting question, Coach, what does a typical day look like for you?
Oh gosh, that's a tough one. You know, because in season, out of season, we're out of season right now. So for me, there are a bunch of different responsibilities. There are a bunch of different, you know, we'd have our recruiting meetings. So keeping up with what we're doing recruiting. I've got speaking engagements coming up in the spring that I go talk to some alumni. So for me, I try to find time during the day where I can steal away and do some football. So
cancel. You can just cancel those speaking engagements. They can listen to the podcast. I think you're
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That's, we just need to link out.
Yeah,
just send the link out to everybody.
Yeah,
So for me, I still like to see my kids in the morning, especially during the off season. So I have three children. And I think it's important that they see my face in the morning before they go to school. So I don't go in that early in the off season. But typically I try to get some things done. I try not to schedule anything for early in the morning so I can watch some film, make some notes, do some scheme evaluation, maybe a little recruiting, maybe some personnel stuff. And then usually there are going to be minimum three knocks on my door that I don't expect. So I just have to accept that and understand that. And whether it's to one of the coaches or the administrative staff or my boss, I just know that minimum there are going to be three times during the course of the day that someone unexpectedly is going to come into my office. So while I have time to work, I get as much done as I can. But as soon as somebody comes into my office with something positive or negative, they have to get my full attention. And until they walk out of my office. So that's a big thing for me. Hard thing for me in the off season is it's the best time to get in better shape. And it's, I force myself to get out. And once I get out, I take a jog around campus. And it's usually the best thing in the world for me because it's the best campus in the world to jog on. So to take a half hour, 5 minute loop, clear my head, get away a little bit, come back. And we usually have some kind of a meeting every other day, whether it's offense, defense, or special teams, or we're doing recruiting, knowing that that's going to factor in my day. But I like to come out of the day knowing that I got a few things done on my own personal list, as well as handling all the random things that do come up during the course of a day.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of wondering, is how you sort out the clutter, like getting pulled so many directions. So you're just kind of clear on like these things have to get done no matter what comes up. Is that how you stay like on task?
Yeah, pretty much. When I first started, I used to, before I would have a list of the things that I want to accomplish the next morning. I think that was very helpful for me as I was becoming a head coach and trying to be as organized as possible. Because when you're a first-time head coach and you're early in your tenure, it's not going to be three knocks on the door. It's going to be 10 to 15.
Yeah.
And I would try to put down at least 10 things on that list, and I know each day I'd get through three. So after I crossed three off that I got done that night before I left the office and try to reprioritize for the morning, knowing that, okay, here are the couple things I'm going to put up top to make sure I get done, but here are the other things that maybe aren't as pressing, but I would like to get done as well. So that's the thing for me, is just to try to be as organized as possible. Right now I don't make the list anymore, but I have an idea of usually the things I want to get done. But even without the list, every once in a while I leave little post-its on my keyboard, just to remind myself of something that may be a long-term thing that I want to get back on top of, or a couple people I need to call back or email back. So I do leave some visuals for myself. But for the most part, hey, when I can get some quiet time, I churn away and try to get some work done.
All right. Time for a few listener questions. First one from Shane Scove. I feel like Shane might be fishing for a compliment here, but he was wondering, if you could morph the qualities of 3X players, what would they be and who would they be?
Shane has never ever fished for a compliment in his life. And since he asked the question, I'll start with him. There's something to be said for competitive fire, and the fire that affects people around you. And that's one thing that was just so great with Shane. It didn't matter who we're playing or where we're playing. During the course of the game, Shane is going to do something full speed and somebody's going to get hit hard. He just knew it. He's going to count on it. And our guys not just expected it, but when it happened, they still responded to it. And I always appreciate those guys that practice games, that do things that affect their teammates. And I think that was one thing that always there was there with Shane. I think for those that are great examples, and 3 years with Christian McCaffrey, even as a freshman, we could just say, do things like him. Like, I'm not going to tell you what to do, right? There's a great living example. Follow him. There's something to be said for those guys that show up every single day and do everything right and go full speed and still have humility and still care about their teammates. I mean, those guys are so rare. A lot of guys can do it most of the time, but those rare guys do it every single day. And that was Christian. Yeah, to the point where, you know, sometimes people would say, "Hey, coach, is that real?" And I would say, "Come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow. You're going to see the same thing. This is just who he is, how he's built." And I appreciate that, because that's hard. That's hard for all of us. That's hard for everybody to, you know, every single day be that same dependable, hardworking person that is real and honest and open, and pushes himself and helps push his teammates. I appreciate humility, and there's no better example of humility than Andrew Luck. And we had a conversation early on, and I mean, we knew, some of us knew when we watched his film as a high school player, some of us knew a little bit when he came to camp. But the year he redshirted his freshman year, everybody on the field knew. He had a whole bunch of nicknames that were just, guys were in awe of him. And his second year at Stanford, when he became the starter, he would go in the huddle and kind of be very matter of fact. And I pulled him aside and said, "Hey, you know what?" I said, "That's your huddle." I said, "You got to go take control of that huddle." And he looked at me very honestly, and he said, "Coach, I haven't played a game yet. I've got some fifth-year seniors in that huddle. Until I play a game, it's their huddle. I need to earn their respect." And this guy like, "Oh, well, by the way, I guess you're right. Sure, okay." But he had that, and he just knew he wanted field credibility. He didn't want to just say, "I'm going to take over because I'm the quarterback and I'm supposed to." He looked at those guys and said, "You guys have earned your stripes, and I'm not going to say more than I need to in this huddle until I earn my stripes." And once he earned his stripes, no question, it was his huddle. He would walk in, he would command their respect, and he would lean on his field credibility. And with every interview he ever given from the time he was in high school, he gets uncomfortable talking about himself. He wants to talk about the offensive line. He wants to talk about the receivers and tight ends and backs. He wants to talk about the defense and the ball back for the offense. He wants to talk about the special teams that set us up with field position. Like, that's what's like Christian. That's this guy every single day. He just believes that's the way it should be. That's the way he's most comfortable. His play makes him the center of attention, but doesn't yearn to be the center of attention. He wants to be part of something great, and he wants to play his role and other guys to play their roles. But when we have success and he has success, he's the first person to point to somebody else and say, "Hey, don't forget to give T.Y. Hilton some praise. He ran some great routes. He made some big time catches. Hey, and I had time to throw the ball. Offensive line played so well today. They kept me clean." That's just how he is all the time. And that's a lot of times more often than being that vocal leader puts you in even more of a leadership role, because you're deflecting the praise. And I think the teammates appreciate that as much as anything.
Those are pretty sweet examples. It was nice of you to fit Shane in there. last question here. We got a listener question from Tavita Pritchard. And he was wondering how your upbringing as a coach's kid has informed your approach as a coach, and can just about your perspective for those of us who are parents and coaches at the same time.
Well, and David is a coach's kid himself. For me, it's a complex answer, and I'll try to give you the short version of my long answer.
Yeah.
For me, I think it's made me aware of a lot without making me callous. Maybe some of the things I may say may sound a little callous, but I'm just aware that I'm in a profession that is different, and I've seen it from young eyes. So I've been in the stands when people have booed my dad by name. I've been in the stands when we've lost games and people have shouted terrible things. I've been in the stands when we've won games and everyone wants my dad to be the next head coach someplace else. So like I've seen it from a young age at the different stages of this. So growing up in it, knowing that there are highs and lows, knowing that the fans' opinions are fickle at best, to say it nicely, and that I can't affect how I do what I do, can't affect what I believe, it can't affect what it can't affect ever the decisions that we make in our day to day. The fact that we had to move multiple times when I was growing up made me more aware that where I'm existing right now is not the only place in the world, that there are other people, other places doing other things. So I think it gave me an appreciation for different parts of the country. You know, born in San Diego, lived in Southern California, Northern California, Oregon, Arizona, Michigan, all before my senior year of school. Wow. So I was able to see a bunch of different parts of the country, and that has affected different coaches' kids in different ways. For me, it gave me an appreciation. It didn't make me resent the profession. I thought it was kind of cool. Now, it also was difficult to say hi and bye to friends. And that was one of the things I just accepted as a fact of my life. And I'm not going to be pen pals. I'm not a whole bunch of letters. We just moved. Hey, sorry, it was great knowing you. If we keep in touch, okay, great. If not, I understand, because now I have a life someplace else. And it allowed me to be present where I was and enjoy where I was, and without saying, hey, you know what, this is the only place I can live. We may move tomorrow. And I think that mentality, I think, helped me be accepting of the things that roll down my path. Because what you find out as a coach's kid or a coach's wife in this profession, you don't have a whole lot of sometimes in where you go. You go where the next job is. And hey, then we were in beautiful, sunny Arizona, and we, in the one off season, we had to move to not so beautiful, sunny Michigan in the winter. That was difficult, different world, but I learned to appreciate it. I think we met great people in Michigan, great Midwestern state with all kinds of really cool things, and had snow days and snowball fights and sled races, and became a better basketball player because we played a lot more basketball. So I think I learned to appreciate where I was and take the things from there. But the biggest thing was being able to handle the things in life that are just rolled down the aisle to me and do the best I could with what was given me.
Well, this was awesome. I think if the football stuff doesn't work out, we can find you a volleyball job. I think you're qualified based on our hour with you. So
I'd have a blast. And the hard for me is I don't want to spike everything until I get to spike everything.
Well, you'd be great. That's all you need to do.
That's how Shane Scope plays too. So, well, I think you wrapped this up perfectly. I don't know if you meant to kind of take us onto the mountaintop there, but that was awesome. This interview's exceeded all hopes that we had, and I know I had pretty high hopes anyway, and you've crushed it. So thanks for your time. This is really just a joy to get a little slice of your world and your mind, and I know a lot of coaches around the world are going to appreciate and learn a ton from this.
Well, I appreciate it. time, and it's great talking to all of you.
Awesome. Thanks, Coach.
Thanks, Coach.
All right. Thanks, guys.